Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Ganatantra podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Alok Prasannakumar.
And I am Saryu Natarajan.
And we are very excited to bring to you a special episode today featuring the author Rukmini S. Rukmini has joined us on this podcast. Hi, Rukmini. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Just a brief introduction about Rukmini before we get into the book that she's written that we're going to discuss, which is called Whole Numbers and Half Truths. And it's about data in India. Rukmini S. is an independent data journalist based in Chennai, India. Her work focuses on inequality, gender, caste, and politics. Rukmini was previously a national data editor of The Hindu and now writes independently for Indian and international publications. We're very glad to have you on the podcast, Rukmini. So let's kick off with usually the question that we ask all our guests. What was the motivation and thinking behind the writing of this excellent book, which for listeners, it covers a number of areas, and even today you'll only get a briefest glimpse of what this book is about. So given that it covers so many different areas from a data perspective, what was on your mind, Rukmini, when you decided to start work on the book?
So I think something that happens with a lot of writers is they have this sort of burning question or burning all-consuming idea that's been bubbling for a long time. That actually wasn't the case for me. I didn't have a book in me, or I didn't think I had a book in me. And this was for a couple of reasons. One is because I've always been a working sort of daily newspaper journalist, which gives you very little time to ever think, the stop and think at length about the breadth of what you've done. And I've been a journalist since 2004. I first was a sort of beat reporter, and then I moved to data journalism in 2010. I'd never really taken a break except when I had my kids, which doesn't lend itself to sort of deep considered thinking. Maternity leave doesn't lend itself to that. So I suppose I had been writing all of this work and doing all of this thinking around what good data can tell us about India, as well as what my experiences on the field and my conversations with experts had shown that the data misses. I spent a lot of time thinking about it, but I hadn't really thought about whether it all added up into a sort of grand narrative or what the bigger question here was. Sometime in 2020, I got talking with the political scientist Pratap Bhanu Mehta about something. And for this, I had to send him a bunch of articles that I'd written. And when he read them at one go, he said, he had very kind things to say. And then he said, you're sort of covering so many meta themes about India. This would make for a good book where you could look at 10 big questions and sort of look at what the data says about it. And that's the first time I really sort of thought that this could be pulled together into a book. And I think one of the problems with being a daily journalist is it leads to a sort of hubris where you feel that you or one of your friends or colleagues has said everything, because something is being said every day. But it's important to have that lesson in humility that sometimes it's not added up to anything. And I wouldn't say not added up to anything, but not added up to a big cumulative step forward in public understanding. So I think part of the reason I hadn't thought about a book is because I felt all of this was known. I keep writing about this stuff. Others do too. This stuff is well known. So it was a good sort of reminder to me to begin talking to my agent, Anish Janvi, who runs the literary agency Labyrinth, as well as Kartika VK at Westland, my publisher. A good reminder that extremely engaged people who know about the broad issues too found enough surprising in what I had to say. And then it felt like, yes, I could see a book coming together, and I pulled this together as a sort of a way to bring together the work I had done, as well as add to it, as well as sort of, to use a word that I usually hate listening to, problematize it a bit, and not present everything as fact or certainty, because I had come around to the feeling that this was not all fact and certainty. So that's how the book came about.
No, that's fascinating. And I was, at least for myself, a very enthusiastic reader of your pieces at The Hindu. You recall we've had many conversations and discussions about the data relating to sexual assault cases in Delhi and then in Bombay, which you did a lot of very interesting work on. For those of you who are interested, we will be putting up some of the links to the articles that we're talking about in the podcast description. So please check them out. Which also sort of brings me back to some of the fundamental points made in the book, which is that it's not as if you're personally generating a lot of the data, except in a few cases. But there is clearly a data architecture there in India. And I've heard this said, though I don't have personal experience of it, that the official data architecture in India to collect data about the country on various metrics and various standards is supposed to be one of the best in the world, or at least all other things being equal, for a country with its resources and constraints, India possibly does one of the best jobs in its data collection. We know our census exercise, obviously the second largest in the world, but there's also a series in terms of the National Family and Health Survey, which comes out much more frequently. And we do have a lot of data to talk about. But at the same time, and as you've just pointed out, and I wanted to sort of maybe think, elaborate a little bit more on this, people don't seem to see that data is telling us the interesting stories or the more accurate stories. And we have a bunch of myths. So what did you find about this when you were writing this book? That, you know, people, you see the data, you see this big set of numbers, and you see the narrative, which seems to be, you know, at 90 degrees to the data itself.
Yeah, no, a bunch of points in that are really important, and that I've thought a lot about in the last few years. One is, you know, you led in by talking about how, for the most part, I'm not personally generating data. And I think this came to me very late as a realization, because when you compare yourself with data journalism going on around the world, you feel that scraping and sort of creating new data sets from information that isn't already out there is the cutting edge and is what you should be doing. And you feel that telling stories from existing government data is boring or uninteresting or not exciting or shouldn't be what data journalism is, should be what government press releases are. And it's really been an epiphany for me to realize that communicating foundational truths about the country based on information that should have been widely available and isn't, for some structural issues that are solvable now, is what I feel is my broad mission. I don't any longer feel that scraping Twitter API to do something is what I feel is most important. And yes, that comes back to, why is this the case? Why is it that these foundational truths don't exist? Is it that we don't collect the data? Is it that the data is faulty? Or is it that we don't communicate it, or a bit of all of it? And reading about the history of how Indian statistical architecture came about, even though we broadly all know the contours of it, which is, you know, we know about the colonial apparatus, we know about Mahalanobis, reading more closely about it really gave me a sense of perspective, as well as a sense of why things are as they are right now, both the good and bad of it to some extent. And, as one of the things to read about this, I would highly recommend Nikhil Menon's book, Planning Democracy. I enjoyed very much the chapters about data and statistics, where he talks about the founding moments and the sort of role that Nehru, Mahalanobis and others thought that statistics should play in the planning of a then poor country. So that sort of sets the tone for why India's statistical architecture you know, has been put in place in the way that it has. Sorry, I don't know whether to pause for a minute because Alok, okay, so, sorry, it was frozen at my end, so I wasn't sure if it...
Don't worry about it.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry. So I think what ended up happening as a result of these, you know, historical processes was that statistics were seen as central to planning for a country with a very stated ambition of lifting people out of poverty at the, you know, the founding moment. But what did end up happening, and in some ways this makes me feel like this needs like a you know, ISRO Netflix style show, except about maybe the ISI, and in this case I mean the Indian Statistical Institute, because the scope of the statistical architecture that was envisioned and put in place then was audacious and far beyond what a country of at the level of income and development should have been dreaming of at the time. You know, it led to visits from countries overseas, from heads of leaders from overseas. It also led to the first large-scale household survey of this kind anywhere in the world, not just in the newly decolonizing world. So what we had then is, in particular, the national sample system, this frequently conducted household level, you know, sampling system that was put in place. We also have the census. We have other wings of data collection as well. And this means that we have had a standardized, well-vetted, internationally recognized system of collecting statistics for over 75 years now. And it provides a rich time series for economists and others from across the world to produce a truly impressive body of research that rests on these numbers. So it's not just that we have this great architecture, we have incredible research that's gone on around all of this for decades now, which then brings me to, why is it then that we know so little about it, or sort of the common person knows so little about it? And I think two things have happened. One is certainly a failure of communication. And I don't necessarily mean communicating the findings. I think that does happen to some extent. But we've done such a poor job of communicating how this data is collected that we've made it two things. We've made it, one, opaque and sort of unintelligible to most people, which then leads people to be turned off by thinking that they don't understand it, rather than the fact that they've just not been explained it well enough. That's one. And we make it open to suspicion, which is now something I realized, that a huge number of young people in particular treat official statistics with huge suspicion. That sometimes comes from a place that's not entirely founded. I mean, I don't think anyone is here to argue that India's statistics are beyond reproach on all fronts. But I do think that the extent of suspicion with which people sometimes regard the numbers, to the point that young people, particularly young journalists, sometimes tell me, we don't use numbers in what we do because we think they're all fake. I think this is where we've come as a result of it. So I do think that, you know, we've done a bad job of explaining how numbers are collected. I think if you stopped most journalists or many students and perhaps even a large number of economists in their tracks and asked them to explain to you how exactly the GDP is calculated, I don't think you'd be left much the wiser in many cases. And as a result, you and I are left, you know, uncertain with how without the tools to understand it. And then when there are problems, as there were a couple of years ago when the methodology to sort of estimate the GDP was changed, the instant thing that people's minds go to then is manipulation, fudging, faking, that sort of thing. Because, you know, if you don't know what goes in, any change seems, you know, fraught with bad intentions. So that's my sort of long-winded answer to where and the, one sort of final point on the statistical architecture I want to make is that you see this in many fields. We often paint India's bureaucracy as huge, too big, massive, slow moving, too many people. But one of the things that India's statistics have suffered the greatest from is too few people. We do not have enough people employed to do the hard job of collecting numbers properly. We've moved to part-time enumerators with some of our most key statistics, which could potentially have an impact on the actual numbers. We might actually be underestimating female employment, for example, by not having fully trained enumerators. So that's my final point on what's happening to India's statistical architecture now. And then we could go on to talk about other pressures on it, you know, further down.
Sure. Thank you. That was fascinating to hear. But I was wondering if I could sort of pull out a little bit from the statistical architecture itself to talk about some of the sort of, I guess, politics around measuring itself. I mean, there's one school of thought around like James C. Scott, who sort of challenged the assumption of wanting to see like a state and sort of centralized data architectures and some of the injustices they perpetuate. But I'd love to hear your take on, you know, the notions of measuring versus not measuring at all, and what datafying certain aspects of polity and society might mean, both in terms of its implications on the architecture itself, but also in terms of what kind of stories we tell about our society.
Thanks for that. And you know, you see this thinking a lot in the early years around, you know, if this is in some ways a very 50s moment as well to think about this sort of, you know, these sort of impulses of control, of you know, state expansion or state control, all of that. And I think this debate of how much of planning and statistics is state control and how much of it is welfarism is evergreen in some ways, and we've had versions of it for decades now. I think, you know, you see echoes of it, for example, with the Aadhaar discussion as well, which is brought down to it in some ways. This is the question. In the, you know, during the pandemic, for example, I remember feeling very frustrated that we didn't have good data on real world vaccine effectiveness. So I don't mean this from vaccine trials, but just in terms of understanding what outcomes the likelihood of hospitalization was for people who were vaccinated versus non-vaccinated in India. And, you know, we do know that since these are vaccines that are well studied, we do know that we would be seeing it, but it was very hard to quantify. And I sort of came down to realizing that one of the reasons we did have some information from this is because the data that you have from the NHS in the US, in the UK, which was using to some extent the same vaccine that we were, tracks a person right from testing, vaccination, hospitalization outcomes, all of that through one centralized number. And, you know, that was also a moment we started talking about things like a national health ID, and there was sort of widespread opposition to that. But then again, thinking around what a national health ID could have potentially done for this sort of, you know, measurement of outcomes, that's simply not possible otherwise. So, you know, this question comes up in many communities and many forms. I think particularly for people on the periphery, whether physically or sort of, you know, through socially imposed discriminations, this becomes particularly important. So, you know, there's excellent work by two economists at Azim Premji University on Nagaland alone, and sort of work around what certain, you know, to me at least, it sort of made me think about what certainties from data do to planning and do to, you know, in terms of a place's notion of itself even. So that's sort of very thought-provoking, and, you know, you see similar cause to think around notions of citizenship, which will come up whenever the census is conducted, and what it means to participate versus not participate in that exercise. It's all sort of, you know, I absolutely do not have an answer on it, but I see the challenges just, you know, multiplying as we go forward. I think people would typically have had a sort of view of the census as a benign exercise until a couple of years ago even. But what our thoughts are when the census is finally conducted, it's going to be a far more difficult way of thinking about it. And it comes down to all sorts of, you know, even questions around food and food preferences. Just this morning, I was reading something in the Indian Express, which looks at data from the education department in Karnataka, which in some areas offered eggs to children, and in some areas they were not offered, or they were given a choice between eggs and, I think, bananas and chikki. And the numbers that it shows over there in terms of children who did opt for eggs, I have not looked at the data in detail, but it would raise questions about whether our official statistics, in which an enumerator ostensibly from the government goes to a house and asks whether you eat meat or not, I think those numbers are far lower than what this is showing, for example. So, you know, given the debates around this going forward, what we should think about, you know, self-disclosure around contentious issues of this sort, these are all difficult questions. And it also makes it challenging to think about the relationship between people and the state and statistics and our expectation of those numbers and what it means for people's sort of safety really is. So, yeah, no, I don't have an answer on it, but I do see it becoming more and more challenging going forward.
I actually read that article, Rukmini, because obviously I'm sitting here in Bangalore and I'm curious about these things. And for me, it kind of tallied somewhat to, I think, the last survey which asked about food preferences in Karnataka. It was only maybe about 4-5% off.
I see.
If you just add up the children who chose the bananas and the chickies and compared with the eggs, I think it was about 80-odd%. And Karnataka, yeah, in the last census, the last such survey showed about 25% or so. So,
okay,
in a sense, if anything, of course, it shows that perhaps it both are fairly robust in there, because for me, what I think was the biggest takeaway was that, hang on, the government almost just conducted just a RCT, something like an RCT.
Yeah.
I think because it was not even an RCT, this was just like a trial of a policy.
Yeah.
Across the entire state. And we have actual data to make a decision on.
Yeah.
Nobody can refute this data. Because you literally gave a choice to the children, and more than 80% of them very clearly said, we want eggs.
Yeah.
So in that way, I thought that was the fascinating part of that particular experiment. But
yeah,
since we sort of got into the topic of politics of the data and so on, and given that this is a big year for elections across India, mostly state level elections, one thing, and you know, the origins of this podcast were in the context of elections. We see a lot of data thrown about in the context of elections. And after much discussion with a lot of people, I'm coming away with the sense that, you know, everybody sort of force fits theories after the results are out. Do we actually know what an Indian votes on the basis of, how they think about these issues? Do they think of caste, gender, policies, ideas? I get the sense perhaps we don't really know. And I think that's something that your book kind of covers.
No, I agree. And I think my answer would be that I think we do not know, because any sort of sense that we have of things below the surface comes from bringing together multiple disparate surveys. I am yet to find one opinion poll that I feel gets at the heart of sort of, you know, bringing these questions together. And I think so there's a couple of things here. I think one of the things that happened is some level of frustration with political journalism, which was highly subjective and in recent times quite apparently, you know, very susceptible to bias, leading to a lot of people sort of getting put off from it and feeling that that you come away no closer to understanding anything except that individual sort of experience of that constituency or, you know, sometimes going on to say that state or that country. So I think there was maybe before the 2014 elections, an extremely sort of strongly felt need for seeing better data. So there's been more data, but I think better is still something we're some distance away from. And I think we have a couple of problems here. One is we have a huge incentive structure problem with how we do opinion polling in India, which is that it's commissioned by media organizations. And media organizations are not interested in studying the citizens' relationship with politics and politicians and political parties. They're interested in that single number of knowing who's going to win how many seats. And I don't mind that. I just think that we have a problem with trying to feed off the sort of what we believe is the you know, the spillover from those surveys. The other questions that are asked, which are things like, what is the top issue you'll be voting for? Do you care about, you know, rank, religion, caste? And then sort of assuming that this tells us important things about the way people vote or their relationship with politics. So one of the sort of, you know, almost pieces of received wisdom that you'll see time and again repeated about Indian voters, particularly in the last 10 years, is that religion doesn't matter, caste doesn't matter, this is a post-caste society, people want jobs, people vote on the economy. And this usually is through a survey question that is asked about what is the top issue you're going to vote for. People will say unemployment, economy, jobs. And so that is the, you know, end result. And I have been guilty of literally interpreting such surveys myself, because if they're open-ended questions, you feel like this is it, this is what people are saying. But then the more you look at multiple other surveys, you start looking at things that you feel should have all come together. So for example, if you look at 2014, you'll find that prior to the election, a large number of people said that they were going to that they were voting because of economic conditions and because they wanted, you know, improvements in household sort of living standards. But after the election, in which the incumbent was dislodged, most people said in the same survey, in the sort of post-election part of it, most people said that their economic situation was better than it had been 5 years ago. So there's a clear sort of dissonance again there. Again, you see in 2019 that the top issue that people say that they're going to be voting for is unemployment or jobs. And then the incumbent, which has just presided over very high unemployment, is reelected, which again sort of should lead people to think about whether these questions should be taken at face value. Simultaneously, you have surveys where people say things like up to 45% saying that they would want a person of the same caste, you know, winning from their constituency. You have, you know, people saying that all of these other sort of dimensions, people saying that they don't really mind whether somebody has a quote unquote criminal background, something that I have a sort of, I'm very frustrated with this having become a central axis around which Indian politics is discussed. Similarly about money, you know, those we all get in drips and drabs from other surveys and then we sort of put it all together. So perhaps what we need to do in some ways is to de-link the study of people's relationship with politics from elections and do more quote-unquote peacetime surveying to try and understand what people actually think of elected representatives, of, you know, delivery of solutions, that sort of thing. And I think we also do a very poor job of understanding what I think is a very sort of key axis, which is the question of identity and self-respect. And I think when people talk about identity politics, it's usually to try and be dismissive of parties that either stand for social justice or very sort of overtly for the empowerment of particular caste groups. But I think, and you know, you find this in sort of casual conversation anywhere in India, that I do think that notions of self-respect are extremely central to how many Indians view themselves. And I do believe that it has to do with how politics speaks to people. But again, this is my theory, not borne out by data. But one of the things that I wish polls did a better job of capturing.
No, thank you for that. And as a political scientist myself, I absolutely hear you on the need to have like more peacetime studies. And there's almost like an unhealthy obsession with elections. And I also wonder, I mean, and in that sense, my question is about, you know, what motivates data collection in a particular way? Because I guess the first past the post system that, you know, that India has necessitates trying to link back and find what is that one driver. So the obsession with unicausal explanations, along with a system that almost incentivizes a certain form of communication of political information. So I would love to hear your thoughts on what, more broadly, what drives the collection of data frameworks, and specifically in the context of politics. And then also, you know, there's while I agree with the tendency to, you know, to critique stories that are sort of just one or examples of one, there is a delegitimization of local, practical, ideographic knowledge. And perhaps there's a need to recognize it in different ways as formal epistemic knowledge. So I wonder how broader political systems or structures drive the frameworks of data collection. And I'll give you an example from a completely different realm. And perhaps not even from politics, but we did some work on data annotation and labeling, and this is for self-driving cars and those kinds of contexts. And what people do mostly in the global south is label pictures of, you know, electric pole, car, etc. And one of the big challenges of this and the quality of data being collected is often affected by the fact that annotators in the global south don't know what a llama is, or can't recognize objects like sidewalk, but the architecture that is framed for this data annotation is, you know, deeply linked to ideas, values, needs of global capitalist system. So I'm just wondering if quality of survey is, you know, partly functional, but also partly driven by the context and the needs for which it is collected. And I'd love your reflections on that. And I know we're a little bit, you know, not going into what we plan to talk about, which is the health and all of that with the book, but I would love to hear your thoughts on this.
Sure. I think some of the, at least some of the early vocabulary of how opinion polls were framed in India was sometimes borrowed from a context that, that was foreign to India. So I think the fact that questions like support for a Bahubali, a sort of local strong man, or support for people even in the context of money being paid to voters is something that came extremely late to opinion polling or to sort of the analysis of this. In fact, I would even say anything beyond a very direct, what is your caste? Are you voting? Will you vote for someone of the same caste? Beyond questions, as basic as that, I think these sorts of questions around caste and religion have also come very belatedly and perhaps not even yet come properly to opinion polls. And I do think this is from borrowing a structure and a vocabulary of polling that was sort of imported in here. The same formats might make sense elsewhere, but might not do so necessarily here. I agree that you could draw that straight line between FPTP leading to this sort of mode of analysis. But this is something that conversations with voters make it very clear that there are matrices of decisions, and those are never unicausal. And arriving at those, at least arriving at the factors that make up that matrix, should not be rocket science and should not have come so late to the discussion as well. So there might be within this sort of tally of factors, there is one that drives your decision, but we have come no closer to the thali at all. And we don't relate the one key part of it to the others at all. We don't talk of these as trade-offs. We don't do things like rank analysis. So perhaps in a way, what we're doing is importing the same FPTP to our the way of asking questions even. And I think that does, it's just left us a lot poorer. And what worries me deeply is that what is clearly flawed opinion polling has been relied on by those political scientists who work with quantitative data in India for decades now, leading to some established sort of notions around the Indian voter that really should have been junked a long time ago, given the pretty bad data that they were based on. And I don't think political science has had that sort of reckoning. I haven't seen a sort of, you know, open discussion among political scientists who use Indian quantitative data saying maybe we should accept that we've not been relying on very good polls until now. And so perhaps these what we've taken as sort of definitional about Indian voters shouldn't are things that we really should re-examine. I don't see people attempting to do things like replicating findings with other polls or even conducting opinion polls themselves to replicate findings. And I do think that some of these would not be replicated if they were asked in better ways. So we've really narrowed our vision of what opinion polling should do, but we've built a very expansive sort of political theory framework on top of it. And that seems very precarious to me.
Thanks for that discussion. I think, Rukmini, I think that sort of is a call for all of us to think a little bit more critically about some of the established narratives on Indian politics. But something that you mentioned, I think, will help us lead into the next question. You sort of mentioned about employment and being a reason for people voting. And one of the, I think it happens on a 3-month cycle because every quarter new numbers are released and the usual fight breaks out, which is, are these numbers on India's employment and labor and employment believable? Now, obviously, these are sample surveys and everyone can question the methodology, but so it tells us, I think, something deeper about the state of data in relation to India's economy. That seems to make, if we thought there were a lot of concerns about political data, and I think with economic data, given how much it influences day-to-day decision-making in government and even among corporates, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about what your book discusses, about some of the issues with what we think we know about India's economic data.
Yeah, thanks for that. I think one of the things that's happened particularly about data on the economy is that criticism of it has become so sharply divided along such clearly defined left and right lines that it's really sort of stunted discussion around it, because these battle lines have been drawn so clearly. And it's always a good lesson in humility to go back and look at some of these discussions and realize just how old they are, how long they've been going on similar lines. So in some ways, the discussions that still happen in the op-ed pages of the Indian Express have really happened for 40 plus years now on very similar lines. So just to sort of break it down a little bit into what we're talking about. So fundamentally, there are 2-3 ways that you can measure data. Measure data on the economy in particular. And one of it is through household level sample surveys. The other is through more top level data. And some of this can be administrative data. Some of it can come, from other ways in which you measure the GDP or you measure national accounts data. And most of our discussion around poverty, around access to benefits, around schemes, targeting, all of that has come from household level survey data, while data on the GDP, that's much more, from above, is usually used to sort of have more macroeconomic level discussions. And I think what's ended up happening is that there is a literal disconnect between this household level data and this national accounts data. And it's also meant that it's along these two lines, the left and the right have sort of neatly aligned themselves. And what's ended up happening is that I think sometimes neither side has been able to take on board criticisms, and it's done a sort of big disservice to the overall way in which we measure the economy, which is we are now in a situation where national accounts data typically paints a rosier picture of the economy than household level data does. And each side then spends a lot of time in trying to find flaws in the other side's way of measuring things. So that's sort of one key fault line, which through better conversation really could bring things a little bit closer. I mean, I think there are flaws on both sides that need to be taken into consideration. There has been vast amount of ink spilt on this. People have written about it. Angus Deaton has considered both sides of it for over 20 years now, and really all of it is makes for great reading. More broadly, what's happened, I think, is that our official architecture has not been able to keep up with the sort of high frequency data that we would like on the economy now, and that corporates in particular would want from the economy. And this came to a head really with employment data. So India had a sort of slow moving way of measuring employment. And then the government itself tried to move to a faster system, which was called the Periodic Labor Force Survey, which would be conducted every quarter and would be, come out faster. I think that shift perhaps didn't happen fast enough. And what's happened is that we now have a rich private data source for it, which comes from the Center for the Monitoring of the Indian Economy. So what we've had for the last few years are numbers through which we can actually argue against official data, because we now have this sort of rich private data source. There are criticisms of ways the numbers are collected on both sides. There are criticisms of the CMI sample, for example, of not being representative enough. And there's, of course, criticism that official statistics miss a lot of what's going on in employment and the economy. I think what's also happened is some very sort of fundamental breaks from how numbers have been collected in the past, which have led to huge suspicion around data, around the economy. And I do like to make a distinction between places in which, there isn't really cause for great suspicion or hand-wringing, and places where there is. And I think some of the things that have happened around data, around the economy, do give cause to be concerned. So there's at least three areas to be concerned about. One was when data on unemployment was delayed in 2019, ostensibly because of the election, and then released after the election and showed sort of sky high unemployment. Then we had data on household consumption, which was first delayed, then pulled back entirely, withdrawn, and now we have a slightly methodologically changed way of measuring household consumption that will come out, and no doubt some of these same debates by some of the same people will end up happening then, because there has been a change in methodology. And then what happened was with the GDP, a sort of a big change in how the GDP was to be calculated, perhaps not enough clarity around how all the numbers were collected, and then some clear problems with how with some of the databases that were used to make this change. And then the numbers were also backdated, as you need to do to show a back series, which seemed to give cause to worry that the change in methodology was made to make the current government's numbers look better. So we've had these three sort of big disruptions with data on the economy. And more broadly, I think we have private challengers and not enough nimbleness from government data.
That's actually very interesting, because I recall reading a few months ago, I think for those of you who have context on this, there was a sudden and sharp drop in India's wheat production due to early onset of winter across North India. And this caught the government by surprise. But if I recall correctly, there was one former agriculture secretary who said, why aren't you looking at private data? Because 20 years ago, when the last time the government was caught by surprise. They went to the private sector and private sector said, yeah, we knew it was coming because we keep track of far more parameters. We have much bigger sources of data collection. And the government had sort of, you know, imbibed some of those practices and some of those data points. And I suppose perhaps the future, one hopes, is not a sense of competition between, I will say one thing and the private sector will contradict, but the government perhaps, you know, learning from the private sector that this is a kind of architecture and perhaps this is the kind of importance that we need to give to data collection. I want to, on that note about the economy. Yeah.
No, I just wanted to jump in with one thing. I think one area where, which sort of an analogy in my mind is also when it comes to climate data, right? I mean, the government had always been the sort of sole source of all data around, you know, it either came from the IMD or it didn't come at all. And then I think the sort of growth of private weather forecasters has, I do think it has, I mean, hopefully it has helped with, it's definitely helped us as users of this information. But, you know, given that there were some calamitous failures of not reading, you know, data that should have been coming up, right from whether it was from the, you know, from the tsunami on the East Coast, or whether it was the Mumbai cloudburst of 2005, where, you know, we could have used data that was already out there. It didn't need new collection. It just needed more eyes perhaps on it. I do think that there is place for signals, or more people looking at more signals coming from more sources, and, you know, yeah, feeding off each other. But I can't see, particularly in the economy, I can't see it as not being acrimonious, because just because, you know, ultimately it is seen as a referendum of whether a government is doing a good or bad job.
Now, that's a fair point. And I think that's something to have to keep to mind when you're thinking about the economy. I think now that we're coming to the end of the podcast, I wanted to sort of leave with something that since you started writing this in 2020, perhaps you may not have had the full data on this, but since you've run a successful podcast yourself, The Moving Curve, which I used to listen to quite religiously every week during the pandemic, I want to sort of steer the discussion a little bit towards health and COVID and a little bit, because I suppose what we've seen over the last 2.5 years or three, if you want to stretch it a little bit, is one, an enormous amount of data has been put out in the public in the context of public health for the first time in a long time. But that data is also, we realize, political in some senses. Like for instance, this whole controversy about the number of deaths that actually took place in India. I suppose now that controversy has died down a little bit, this was about a year or so ago, I recall that we had a big discussion about nobody's doubting that the government has missed out some deaths, but I suppose the ranges were from 10x the number of deaths to maybe 1.5 times the number of deaths. And this sort of, I suppose, highlighted that even the health data that we're looking at, something very essential and fundamental, there are big gaps there. We rely on data collection architecture that perhaps wasn't suited to this high frequency kind of collection of data. And I think, Saru, you wanted to add something to this question also.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think what COVID and in some ways the broader conversations around data, climate change and technology for climate has done is that it's brought to the spotlight community initiatives around data collection, or traditionally, so even both private and government data collection are often in institutional structures of some sort, whereas community data collection measures aren't necessarily that way. So, I'd love for you to also ponder on how some of these measures might be understood as well as legitimized. So back to you, Alok.
That was it. So I think we'll have a hand over to Rukmini for our two questions that we have bombarded her with.
Sure. I think so. What the pandemic and what the discussion about COVID deaths data in many ways highlighted is just how poor a job our statistical architecture has been doing of capturing disease surveillance and deaths from disease for a while now, and how we have allowed it to sort of atrophy or not keep up to this point, and how how shocking it is that it hasn't been, you know, more of a scandal before. So just to give you an example, if we were to accept the WHO's estimates, that would say that COVID deaths were undercounted by, you know, that the underestimation was 10x. That would have been the WHO's estimate for COVID. In 2017, the last year for which I saw data, India officially reported 192 deaths from malaria, while modeled estimates for the same year placed them at 50,000. So that's a 40x underestimate in routine malarial death counting. There are similarly, or not, if not larger, underestimates for deaths from diarrhea, deaths from TB. And, you know, it's shocking that that this hasn't been a scandal before. We've not had an international incident with the WHO over estimates of deaths from all of these other diseases, while we perhaps should have. And I think, you know, one of the big problems on that count is that our official architecture has relied on doing a reasonably good job of counting deaths from the public infrastructure only, while the majority of Indians now access health in the private system. And we have just not figured out how to do a good enough job of collecting data from private systems. I don't see much evidence that this has got a lot better either. So I don't know how that's going to, you know, I don't see immediate improvement in that. In addition, what was supposed to be our surveillance systems that again, you know, were built in a way that was quite awe-inspiring. How much our surveillance systems fail to pick up is also really something that we should worry a lot about, and how poor the publicly available data from what is being picked up from surveillance systems is really gives me great reason to worry. What happened with COVID deaths data was a combination of a few issues that I think in a way really cuts to the heart of problems with data in general in India, which is that when you hear of this 10x underestimate, your mind goes to, again, manipulation, fudging, faking, lying, suppression. And it's interesting to me to think through how much, you know, how little, in fact, of this would be explained by these sort of malified, in these sort of malified ways. So one is we went into the pandemic with a health system that misses deaths from all diseases. We know we do that. Secondly, we're a country that doesn't yet register all deaths. Many deaths occur at home, particularly in rural areas, and go entirely uncounted. While this might not be a big problem at the national level, it's a huge problem in some states like Bihar, for which the most recent data shows the state only registered 50% of all deaths. Half of all deaths go entirely unregistered. And then cause of death is still something that we're very far from understanding well in India. So in Kerala, the, you know, most developed state of the country, again, the most recent data showed that only 1 in 5 deaths had a medically certified cause of deaths. In Kerala, even the administrative system that's meant to certify cause of deaths has just not developed strongly enough for us to be able to say what people died of. So for all of these reasons, and then you add to it a pandemic that completely overwhelmed not just health systems, but also administrative systems, it would be a real stretch to think that you wouldn't miss deaths in this case. So, you know, that would be entirely to be expected. The extent of undercounting is something on which you know, there might be a difference of opinion, but there are pretty good ways to estimate it. I don't think this was voodoo, you know, mathematics in the way it was made out to be. And although it might seem like this debate is now a year or two old, it's actually going to keep coming up, because we'll keep having, you know, we're going to have a COVID-driven impact on mortality for a few years. We only have the numbers for 2020 so far in India. This whole WHO discussion was up to the summer of 21, and India's official numbers are only up to 2020. We don't have official numbers on how many people died in India of all causes in 2021 yet. And that is really going to be, to me, that will be the most sort of controversial number, because you know, all other estimates are that we had a huge spike in mortality in 21. And even if you look at countries like the UK, for example, I think the UK in 2022 numbers that they've just finished compiling registered the highest increase in mortality in 50 years in 2022. So we should expect this, how much energy people are going to have to continue to sort of fight this narrative, especially when it means an extremely strong pushback from the government. I don't know how much people are going to be willing to have this discussion at the same pitch again. But yeah, so sort of broad takeaways from this were that our health sort of management system and administrative capacities to count disease and death need a lot more work, not just for COVID, for all, all disease. Missed deaths are to be expected. In fact, trying to argue that you didn't miss any deaths makes no mathematical, statistical health sense at all. And so accepting that all countries would have missed counting some deaths doesn't seem to me a big stretch. It doesn't point to having done a worse job of managing the pandemic than anywhere else, which I don't think India did a worse job than everywhere else. It doesn't point to manipulation and fraud, because I don't think that's what led to the numbers being missed. But by consistently refusing to accept that there were any excess deaths, that's a problem. That's when we get into problem territories. And just to sort of finally come to Sariu's point, and it's actually a sort of apt day to be talking about this as well. From the beginning of the pandemic, one of the things that we have had in India is pretty good data coming in from all state governments separately. But what we did not have is a consolidated national effort to bring those numbers together. And so a sort of volunteer-driven community effort called COVID-19India.org came together to bring all of this data together. It was, again, I repeat, official data. No new data was being collected, but it was being brought together and made public, in a way that was not available, that remains not available. That initiative ended in October 2021. And another group called COVID-19Bharat.org took that on, and we've been doing that now since October 2021. So today we've announced that at the end of January, we're closing operations for COVID-19Bharat.org. And in a way, it sort of, talks to me about both the some of the most amazing learnings about what community the sort of public spirited data community in India can do, as well as the limits there. And what it can do is it can really bring together a resource that is of world class quality, that is not expensive, but that is driven by excellent talent who are so public spirited as to be anonymous and do this on a volunteer basis. So all of these wonderful silver linings to learn about. And they can sort of put this together and make this information available to the point that even government, the Economic Survey, for example, used this data in past years. But the limits to it are sort of human limits, which is the ability to then continue to carry this on year after year is difficult. And what's happening now, for example, is that most state governments have stopped putting out these bulletins themselves as state resources get transferred to other things. There'll be other epidemics, there'll be monsoon fevers, there'll be all of these things that state resources get moved to. So in the absence of that, since this data was not being collected anew, it was only putting together what states were willing to do, the combination of sort of the limits of what pro bono work can do, as well as what we have to work with, given that states had stopped putting bulletins out, has led to our decision now to discontinue COVID-19 Bharat at the end of this month. This, of course, comes only as a result of both numbers being low and vaccinations being high. If numbers had continued to be high, despite all of these reasons, we would not have stopped work. But that sort of underlines many of my learnings about community-led data initiatives during the pandemic.
Thank you so much, Rukmini. And I think we'll have to bring this discussion to a close. Like I've said, we could have had this for at least another hour, if not more. But time constraints means that I think we have managed to cover a lot of ground in the last hour or so that we have discussed this podcast. Thank you so much for sparing your time, Rukmini, to talk about the book. The book is, of course, Whole Numbers and Half Truths. Please do check it out online. It's available on Amazon and most other places. With that note, I'll say goodbye from me, Alok Prasannakumar.
And me, Sarayu.
And thanks to our producer, Afra, who's helped us put this podcast together. And thanks to New Books Network. We hope to catch you soon in another episode. See you all and have a nice day.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Rukmini. It was lovely to hear you.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Am I...
Yeah, I think I'll stop.
Let me just stop recording. Yes.